This week in Retronauts, Mario's body is a Wonderland? No, wait, that's not right. Hi, everyone. Welcome to Retronauts episode whatever the hell. I am whoever the hell, Jeremy Parrish. That's right. And I'm here to fake you out. That's right. This episode is called The Wonder of Mario. And you might be thinking, wow, that sounds like an episode about hot new game Super Mario Wonder, perhaps talking about its retro roots and origins and how it holds up to the lineage of the series. And that would be great. That sounds like an amazing idea for an episode. And that's not what this is. No, this is actually, this is a pure SEO grab. You thought we were above those shenanigans, but we're really not. So this episode has nothing to do with Super Mario Wonder, aside from the fact that there is a game coming out in, I don't know, days, weeks, I'm not sure when this is going up, called Super Mario Wonder. And that game represents the latest iteration of a series and franchise that remains as popular and successful and maybe even more beloved than ever. God, like 40 years on. And so, you know, we have to wonder about that. Ah, see what I did there? Yes, wonder. I wanted to stop and look at the handful of games and franchises throughout the history of video games that seem to remain evergreen, that seem to remain in constant circulation. You know, recently, the Video Game History Foundation put out an article, some research, that said, maybe Kevin, who is also on this episode here, and we'll talk once I stop blathering, yes. Once I stop doing that, the VGHF put out research that said something like 87% of video games created before 2010 are not available for any kind of legal play or acquisition these days. Is that right, Kevin? 87?
Yeah, I think that was right. Yeah, it's 87 right. Or 88. It's some absurd number.
So we're looking into that 13% of series and games that were released a long time ago and saying, what is it about these games that endures? And we will start with Super Mario Brothers, but I want to open up the floor and the conversation to people who have much less boring interests and tastes than I do. And so we're going to introduce those people, starting with, I guess, the person whose presence has already been spoiled.
Hi, this is Kevin Bunch, noted Bob Hoskins Mario defender.
What is it about Bob Hoskins as Mario that you find defensible?
You know what? He did a very excellent job of portraying Mario as a middle-class working guy, you know, blue-collar, and I respect that.
And he did it to put his kids through college, so that's admirable, too.
Just like Mario.
All right. So, wait a minute. Is this new canon here? Are we counting the Toads as Mario's kids?
You know?
He's been busy.
Yeah, you know, we'll count Dizzy as Mario's child.
Dizzy,
you know,
hasn't even hatched yet, though. He's still an
it's
egg.
It's very early for me, so it's going to get a little punchy.
Okay. That's the way we like him. So, Who there is the Dizzy defender, the Dizzy advocate, speaking to us from the UK?
I guess that would be me. I'm Stuart Gipp, and I'm an advocate for Adam Buxton as Bob Hoskins. Don't ask. That's the one for the UK people.
Do you actually advocate for Dizzy, though?
I mean, yeah, I guess I do, in that I don't think it's garbage like everyone in America seems to. I think it's pretty good.
I don't think Dizzy is garbage.
Some podcast with I'm so bad with pronunciation. Audie from Limited Run, and he hates Dizzy, like super. Well,
he's not American. He's in Canada right now. That's not America.
Fair play.
What are you
fair play.
About?
Yeah, okay, not Americans then. People who aren't me. So
yes.
In my travels, I generally find them most disagreeable.
And finally, speaking of travelers, we have fresh from Tokyo Game Show and back in the far, far away land of Osaka.
Hello, everybody. My name is Edwin Feit, and in 1988, my favorite TV show was The Wonder Years, and my favorite West Coast Avenger was Wonder Man.
Wow. I wonder why. we probably shouldn't do this.
Okay. I'll stop. That's true, though. I'm not doing a bit.
Yours were fine. Mine was bad. So I probably shouldn't do this. No, we'll play it
straight. He was made of energy. See, he could do anything he wanted.
I wish I was made of energy.
That's wonderful.
If the game is bad, we can all call it Super Mario Blunder.
Ah, there we go.
There it is.
The odds of it being bad are quite low. It's
they are.
Very unlikely to be bad.
But, you know, stranger things have happened. So, Super Mario Wonder, you know, I actually haven't watched any trailers. I've stopped looking at video games before they come out, so that when they do come out, I can be like, oh, neat, if I actually ever get around to them, which doesn't happen that often anymore. So basically, I live in ignorance of video games now, but I will say that, you know, I've seen Mario running around as an elephant, and people seem to think that Super Mario Wonder appears to be new Super Mario Brothers. Which that's really, really new. That's like super fresh. But, you know, ironically, when you put new in front of a Nintendo game title, it actually means old. Like, hey, this is, you know, the old style thing. So that means Super Mario Wonder is doubly old. It just happens to have, you know, HD graphics. But they look like, what's his name? Kotabe, his artwork, you know, the guy who drew all the cool Mario artwork in the 80s. If Bob were here, he would laugh at me and say, his name is this, but he's not here. So someone else, please laugh at me.
Kotabe sounds correct to me. I'm pretty sure that's right.
Okay, there we go. Yeah, I think Kotabe. Okay, so anyway, that's like the new thing. But then everything else seems to be, you know, kind of, and also the elephant thing. But, you know, Mario's been a rabbit and like some other stuff, so not that new. Basically, Super Mario Wonder looks like a modernized take on the classic Super Mario Brothers formula of running around, jumping, stomping on things, moving, you know, kind of back away from the free-roaming 3D world of Super Mario Odyssey. Am I right in this? Like I said, I have not watched trailers for it. I'm just going off screenshots.
It looks like New Super Mario Brothers, except with more drugs and a score attack sort of thing going on.
Okay, and better graphics. Which
I mean, it looks great. Honestly, I think it looks great. I mean, I never had a problem with the graphics in New Super Mario Brothers, but I do understand the criticism. You know,
they're a bit anodyne.
They are a bit. I mean, but you know, Mario is a bit anodyne, isn't he? He's a bit of an anodyne fella. I mean, have you seen the movie? Jesus Christ!
No, absolutely not. I've never seen a video game movie. So
okay, wow. Okay, okay. I'm just thinking about how utopian your life must be.
I've seen parts of Cloak and Dagger, which was about a video game. Oh, and I love Tron, which video games were based on. But yeah,
that's halfway there.
Oh, no, I watched a Street Fighter movie for a Retronauts episode and then said never again. So that's why I don't show up on those episodes.
I retract my comments about your utopian life.
No, it was okay. It was The Legend of Chun-Li. She's cool. I like Chun-Li.
Oh, no. You said Street Fighter movie. I'm like, okay, well, that one's not so bad. And then, oh, no, Legend of Chun-Li.
No, it was also kind of anodyne. It was just kind of like, here's an action movie that happens to be about a character who is from Street Fighter. Anyway, all of this is superfluous to the conversation, which is that Super Mario Wonder, aka new Super Mario Brothers, carries forward a style of gameplay that Nintendo established back in 1985 with Super Mario Brothers. And that's a long time for a specific format of video game design to survive and persist. And I do not doubt that this game will sell tens of millions of copies, partly on the extreme popularity of Mario and, you know, just based on the success of the new Super Mario games and the fact that there's like this influx of an entirely new audience who, you know, they're like 6 years old, saw the movie, weren't old enough to say, oh, this is kind of boring and trite, and said, I love Mario now. So And I'm going on the boring and trite comments, you know, secondhand, just based on people's opinions, whom I trust. So, yeah, there's a lot of secondhand information that I'm building on here. I realize I'm not assembling the most compelling argument based on personal experience, but nevertheless,
I find it's best to dismiss things without experiencing them.
Absolutely. No, as someone who works as a, you know, doing a lot of writing about video game history, so much of my work is based on extrapolating from secondhand sources and, you know, external information and pulling it together into reasonably good conclusions. So this is a case where I'm doing that in the present tense with current day things, new upcoming games, current release movies that are out on Blu-ray now and 4K, please buy today. I'm just, you know, applying the methodology of a historian to the present day. And I feel like that's actually very cutting edge. And I feel like, you know, lots of people will be doing this in the future. But in the meantime, my point is, how has this Super Mario Brothers format survived and persisted despite all the changes that have been thrust upon video games, that have evolved out of video games over the decades? I mean, if you look at the games that are big now, games that are, you know, pulling in real numbers, they look nothing like anything that was being shipped when Super Mario Brothers made its debut on NES in 1985. And yet here we have this game, Super Mario Wonder, which is going to sell gangbusters and dominate the charts and probably will get great reviews and just be very popular and beloved. Like, how is this, you know, last dinosaur, this strange Neolithic creature able to survive amidst the modern day era? My theory here is, you know, obviously Nintendo knows how to make good games, but they also make bad games. There's no guarantee here. No, my premise for this episode is that some games just land at the right time, do the right thing, hit in the right way to lodge themselves into the collective consciousness and establish themselves as just this kind of evergreen thing that will always be there, always be popular. People will always go back to it, especially the people who experienced it at the time. Like, it just resonates with them, and they never quite manage to shake their love for it. So in this case, I'm saying that about the original Super Mario Brothers, that it hit at a time in a place that made people say, this is amazing. And it's, you know, it's been dining out on that legacy for almost four decades. And, you know, it has many, 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 many successors. And very few games have managed to do that. We're going to talk about some of them throughout this episode. But first, I'm going to put forward the premise, the theory, the claim that Super Mario Brothers, the original, did this in 1985. And I want to ask if everyone agrees. But also, because you do agree, I would like for you to help me extrapolate and you know, expound on this and say what it was about Super Mario Brothers that was so amazing in 1985 that justifies it continuing to be, you know, republished and put on NSO and so forth and given sequels and movies and so on and so forth in the year 2023. So I put it to you, what is so amazing about Super Mario Brothers here in the year 1985?
Well, it's fun to collect coins.
Yeah, that's true.
Thanks for listening. Support the Patreon at $5 level. I'm sorry.
But you could collect coins in the original Mario Brothers, and yet people are not going back to the original Mario Brothers and saying, hell yeah, that is not... Mario Brothers Wonder is not coming out soon for Nintendo Switch.
I guess for 85, I mean, I'm going to ignore stuff that's sort of not a revelation sort of now, because you could say things like, it's one of the earliest examples of a sort of popular, not really narrative, but linear, like, single stages, no... arcade style sort of looping kind of thing, where you can start to finish, see the ending, beat the boss, get the princess, and if you want, you're kind of done. But it's for it to still be popular today, that it's got to be more than that. So I mean, the problem for me is, I get, it's just a perfect storm of good level design, great momentum controls that are really, really just like intuitive. And the simple to understand systems where if you're big, you can break blocks. If you're small, you can't break blocks and will die all the time. There's not even that many sort of different types of enemies in there, but they each fulfill a very sort of specific function and interact with each other in interesting ways. I think it's impossible to pinpoint exactly what gives it the sort of X factor. It's just really, really good at what it does. It's really short, but not short enough to feel like you're being shortchanged. The warps mean that there's, you know, mystery to it. Something to talk about. A major factor is, you know, the speedrunning obviously has kept it in the sort of public eye, because it was one of the earliest sort of speedrun games, as memory serves. Because I remember seeing, like, tiny roleplay videos of people absolutely rinsing this game way back in the day. But yeah, it endures.
So it's interesting that you say Super Mario Brothers is short, because I distinctly remember being alive in 1985 and seeing this game and saying, holy crap, that it actually seemed so enormous, so vast. At the time, you know, we were used to arcade games that, you know, had like two or three stages, you know, maybe four. Usually they had kind of like minor variations. Oh, it's now you're in the stage that looks like the first stage, except instead of being green, it's pink. Super Mario Brothers was huge. It had 32 stages, and it seemed like every stage had all these little obscure secrets hidden throughout it. And, you know, I first experienced the game secondhand. I had a friend who owned an NES very early on, and of course he played Super Mario a lot. And sometimes he would let me play Super Mario, but mostly he'd let me watch him play Super Mario. So for me, there was this enigma about the game. It was so mysterious, and he seemed to know so much about everything in it. And I just couldn't begin to grasp, like, how do you know to hit that block and it causes a vine to come out that takes you into the clouds? That's crazy. What is that?
If you want a game to lodge itself into your psyche, in fact, I did an episode about this with Dave Ballmer, it's coming out in the future, it has to not be yours. Someone else has to own it, and then you will spend your childhood coveting everything about it and wanting to play it, and it will seem like the most interesting game imaginable, because you only get to play it for 5 seconds.
My God.
No, that's very true, because we did not own video games when I was a kid, and I think all video games are mysterious and wonderful and desirable. So,
well, they are.
Yeah, the trick, I think you're right, the trick is deprivation, and because I was deprived of basically any video game until, you know, I was in my teens, basically, I spent my childhood coveting, and that's imprinted itself on me. But I do want to ask, is anyone else in here old enough to remember when Super Mario Brothers was new?
Yes.
And thank God. Okay.
I'm going...
Speak, fellow mummy.
I want to slightly disagree with the premise here, in that I believe that Super Mario Brothers captivated and translated what was expected of arcade games and turned it into a very compelling home game, because it still functions around that live... the live mechanic. You know, you get three lives and then you have to stop playing the game. But as you explore, there's plenty of opportunities to get more lives, to get more Marios, to get more chances to keep going. And, you know, as I said, Stu said it's not that long. You said it seems long. I will say I thought it was long until I actually looked at all the levels, and then you realize that at least 25% of the levels are just reused of the other earlier levels. Like, they do recycle things in that game.
If I can chime in, I think what it is for me is, when it came out, it was long. It's not long now. Like, to play it now is incredibly breezy, I think. I mean, unless you're doing every level, obviously, then it's less so. But that's not how anyone plays.
15 minutes as opposed to 5.
I think the only reason that you would do that is a self-imposed challenge, because when I play this game, I tend to, you know, 1-1, 1-2, 4-1, 4-2, 8-1.
Yeah, so when I use Super Mario Brothers footage in my NES Works videos, I always pull footage from like World 5, World 6, World 7, like all the worlds that people skip, World 3, because I'm like, oh, those poor little guys, no one knows what they look like. There's some neat stuff there. As you know, just it's just like I'm out there rooting for them. I'm like, come on, guys! People have to know you exist too.
Well, that's what I mean. That's what makes it one of the things that makes it so enduring is that you in your first when you first play this game, you don't know about the warp zones, and you might stumble across the one in world on like, the second level because it's really not that hard to find. And then you'll know they exist, and from then on, you can skip to wherever you want to go. I mean, the one in 4-2 is much harder to find, so most people are probably going to miss it on their first play, second play, third play, and then one day maybe you'll stumble across it. But until that point, you'll be doing as many levels as you have to do until you find your own path through
it. If you try to use the warp zone trick from 1-2 on 4-2, it's just going to give you a warp to World 5, which doesn't really seem worth it. So to find the real warp that takes you all the way to the end, you have to figure out the other tricks. And yeah, that's just clever. Like, rewarding someone for doing something they shouldn't, and then when they do the thing they shouldn't again, expecting to be rewarded the same way, give them like a breadcrumb, but not a real reward. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, there's a lot of thought put into how everything in Super Mario Brothers works. And, you know, I will say, as someone who remembers when the NES was new and looking at Kung Fu and being like, whoa, that's amazing. And then seeing Super Mario Brothers and saying, this looks awesome. There was something about the visuals, like just the crisp, bright colors. I know people don't always love the NES palette, but, you know, for the colors that it uses, Super Mario Brothers is just perfect. Like the blue skies and the green bushes and Mario's distinctive, you know, it's not super garish or anything. It's just like, just the right use of color, the sound design, like the coins and the distinctive, you know, the little burp of fireballs and the little pop of an enemy being hit by a fireball, like the sort of accordion slide whistle of sliding down the flagpole. Just everything fits together so perfectly. It's just in terms of what you expected from a console game in 1985-86, it was incredible. It really did feel like an arcade quality experience. Yeah, and that had a big impact. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I remember distinctly the first time I saw this game was at my uncle's house, and my cousins were playing it, and in the other room they had an Atari 2600 set up with some other games, and I remember going back and forth between the rooms and just marveling at how Super Mario Brothers, it looks like a cartoon, like it's so, you know, bright and colorful and so high definition comparatively. And I think at one point they were actually playing the original Mario Brothers on the 2600, and that is a comparison, let me tell you, that has stuck with me for decades at this point.
I know I'm talking too much, so I apologize, but I think that Super Mario Brothers visually is a bit of a problem for me because you talk about sort of the people not liking the NES palette, but I can't look at this game as an NES game. It just looks like Super Mario Brothers. Do you know what I mean? Everything is so completely iconic. I know almost every pixel of everything in this game. And when I look at it, I just see the stuff from Mario. I don't see like Mappas or whatever. I don't see like tiles. I just see Mario. So I can't judge this game visually. It just looks perfect to me.
Yeah, that kind of touches on something that I kind of realized as I've been making NES Works videos and then covering Famicom games. Like, for Americans especially, people in the US, Canada, North America, Super Mario Brothers is the NES. Like, those two things came out together. Super Mario Brothers wasn't the game that Nintendo really pushed at the NES launch, but it was the one that made everyone stop and say, holy crap, this is amazing. And so they leaned into it pretty quickly. But, you know, at the time, I don't think they really... If you look at their early promotions, it's all about Rob and Duck Hunt and Excitebike and things like that. Whereas, you know, the game that really endures from the NES launch is Super Mario Brothers. But in Japan, the Famicom had been out for more than 2 years by the time Mario came out. And so it hits differently for them. To them, you know, people who were playing Famicom games in 83, 84, 85, Super Mario Brothers is more of a culmination. Whereas here in America, it's more like, this was a sea change. Like, video games had been dead for a year or two. And then all of a sudden, bam, here is this incredible adventure. It's so huge. It's so colorful and bright. There's so many secrets. There's so much to do. It was just, you know, it's important to players from both regions in very different ways. And I can't speak for Europe because the NES wasn't really that popular there. But nevertheless, even as you say, like, to you, that is a game that kind of stands on its own. It doesn't, it's not tied to NES specifically, but it's still like an iconic work.
You know, you can go out and you can buy like pin badges of like a Buzzy Beetle or like the exact sprite of Super Mario. It turns up in so many different games as a kind of a throwback in like this Switch, Nintendo Switch UI even has that sort of Mario iconography there. And of course, Mario Maker turns it into even more of a kind of piecemeal sort of thing. So yeah, for me, it just doesn't register as, yes, this is a product of the NES limitations. I do think it's a perfect looking game. There's nothing that I can point at and say, graphically, this isn't right. But I can't criticize the visuals in that game on any level, nor could I even begin to understand how anyone could. It's just too ingrained in my psyche now.
Yeah, I mean, for me, owning an NES, like, that did actually kind of work against Super Mario Brothers for a while because, you know, games started to look more detailed, have more complex offerings just in general. Everything about them became more complex. And so Super Mario Brothers for me quickly became deprecated. I was like, oh, that's old and boring and stupid. And, it was only years later that I came back to it and said, oh, actually, no, it looks simpler than other Mario games and, you know, other games on NES. But this game is still actually really good. And, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if you look at, say, Super Mario Brothers 3, which is, you know, one of my favorite games of all time, and I'm not throwing shade at it because I'm not insane, but that game, for its much more detailed graphics, you can see where the palette is lacking in places. You can see where it looks a bit faded, looks a bit, like, you know, washed out, because it hasn't got the bright colors to depict what it's trying to depict. And it looks amazing, don't get me wrong, but to me, that's got a very distinct, almost sort of faded look to it, whereas Super Mario Brothers is just dynamic as hell, and it just pops, you know. It just looks incredible, I think.
Yeah, I think Kevin or Diamond, one of you mentioned something about how the game was trying to translate the arcade experience, and I think the last thing. Okay, way to go. Well done. No, this is the last thing I'm going to say before we move on to another game, but I do think that Super Mario Brothers offered something really interesting at the time, which was the sort of player-controlled ratchet scrolling. So the game could be really fast. If you just wanted to bust ass and you knew your way through the levels, you can haul. You can just run. But you can also sort of pick your way through, break as many blocks as you want. You can, like, destroy the entire environment if you want to run down the clock and you've got a super mushroom. And you're going to find secrets for it. Not a lot, but they're there, and it's enough to entice you. But you can't go back. You can never go backward. So every time you play, you want to poke at it in different places and, like, say, well, you know, I only have time to, like, break every block on this screen, so what am I going to find here? And it really teases out just the desire to see what's there and explore in a way that, you know, an action game shouldn't be able to do. It's just a combination of concepts that seem inherently contradictory. And I think by leaning into that, you know, that's an element that would become a big part of Nintendo's games, especially starting with The Legend of Zelda, is just like, hey, what's here? Figure it out. Explore. See what's there. And, you know, marrying that to this sort of forward scrolling only, you know, there's a time countdown, you've got to go, there's challenges, there's monsters coming at you, sort of arcade mentality, really was something unique and different at the time. And, you know, it really just helped Super Mario make this huge impression and become really kind of the cornerstone of Nintendo's video game design for the next 40 years. And that's a hell of a thing to do, you know, in the space of, like, they had probably had 6 months to design this game, and, you know, it was like 3-4 people, and look what they did. It's crazy. They should not have been able to do that. And they did. And, you know, I think, it's kind of hard to overstate how much this game and the people who designed it contributed to just the art of video games. So yeah, I feel like, you know, the wonder of Super Mario Brothers is that they just got it right, and it's amazing. Any final thoughts on Mario before we head along to other topics?
I just think it's funny, we talk about the graphics and the colors, and like this ostensibly launched Mario into a new stratosphere, and yet this is the last time Mario will look like that, because red and brown is just not that great a look.
Well, you try working in a sewer pipe and keeping the brown off your uniform.
Changed in some proper fresh overalls later. So, Mario, great. Let's move along to other people's lists. And I believe, Diamond, you are the next here with a set of games. Let's start with the one at the top, because it's very different from Mario. Assuming this is yours, I put it down as yours.
It is mine. It's my list.
Well, and let's go for it.
As a matter of fact, not to date ourselves, but we're recording this podcast on the 30th anniversary of Myst.
Whoa, no kidding?
Yeah, it's today.
Well, you are the keeper of Retronauts' historic anniversaries, so mm-hmm. I trust you on this.
And Myst is a game that I feel qualifies for this these standards, because it is a game that sort of came out of nowhere and exploded. And one of the reasons it exploded is because it didn't look like anything else, it didn't sound like anything else, and it didn't play like anything else. So it really broke... It broke the mold, so to speak, and I feel like it gave people a glimpse of, you know, I mean, obviously there's a captivating sense to it. It makes you feel like you're going somewhere else, but I also feel like the way they present this game, it's a first person, you're exploring an island, there's no HUD, there's very limited dialogue, you know, there's some people in books who tell you to help them, but like that's about it. You're not finding lengthy diary entries. What you're really doing is you're solving these puzzles as best you can. Most of them are nonverbal. Most of them are nonlingual. You know, most of them are just like, find a pattern here, connect these sounds. The worst one, of course, is play this goddamn piano. But and to talk about arcades, like Myst is absolutely a rejection of everything an arcade game would be, you know? Myst is a game where it's like, here, come in, play this game. Almost nothing can go wrong. Like, you can get stuck. You can make a mistake. You can get stuck. That's true. That can happen. But no one can kill you. You never run out of lives. You never run out of time. You just go, and you play it until you finish it. And there's more than one ending, which is also fun. And just for me, you know, I was a teenager when it came out, and I was just, you know, to talk about coveting, yeah, this was a game that I absolutely... When this came out, I didn't have a computer that could run this. Like, it was impossible for me to run this. So it was just something I would play at other people's houses or hear about. And I'd be like, oh, wow, look at this. Oh, wow, look at this. And then I would have to, you know, years later, fumble my way through, like, various ports of it until I finally got to, you know, enjoy it myself. But, yeah, that's my case for Myst holding up. And it's funny that, I argue that Myst still retains a lot of what makes Myst work then still works today, in that you have a lot of games today, so-called walking simulators, are also all about, here, come around, explore this world, you can't run out of lives, you can't die, you're going to solve some puzzles and tell a story, whatever. The fact that they keep making new versions of Myst, and really the primary difference is, oh, now you actually get to walk around now, whereas before it was a slideshow, but it's still fundamentally the same game. It's just like, now you have to, you know, now you've better controls. But the puzzles don't actually change, and the island doesn't actually change. You know, the fact that I played Myst, you know, in Unreal Engine or whatever 2 years ago, and I was still super into it. I think that's amazing. I think that's why I love Myst.
And now you can play Myst in VR and never have to leave the island.
Yeah, well, I can't because that'll throw up. But still, people who can do that can enjoy Myst in the ultimate first person, like directly on their eyeballs.
Yeah, I think you can tell that Myst really hit just based on how many missed parodies existed at the time. Mm-hmm. There's what, three of them?
I can't let this go by. You said missed really hit. That's really funny because you could have said hit really missed. You know, never mind. Carry on.
It's too early for me to be clever. I'm sorry.
Okay.
But yeah, I just remember off the top of my head, there was Pissed.
They got John Goodman for that one.
They got John Goodman.
Like, not a small budget.
TV's John Goodman, yeah.
There was a porn one that I'm not sure if actually came out, but they sure advertised it. I'm blanking on the name.
Was it called Jizzed?
It shockingly was not.
Okay.
It's too early to work blue.
But yeah, this was a game that I didn't really get to play at the time. I didn't play it until, I was in college. I'd just gotten a Saturn, and it came with the Saturn version of Myst, and I was very, very confused by the game, but I know so many...
Is it because the video window was so tiny?
It was not a game I knew what to expect going in, and if it's not a game that you don't have any, knowledge of going in, it's very obtuse and kind of confusing. I don't know how many people can go into Myst fresh these days, because I've talked to so many people and met so many people over the years who have told me, oh man, I loved Myst, that game was great, you know, I could replay it right now. And I'm like, cool, I mean, they have a Myst festival or convention specific to that series that goes on, annually in, I think, Seattle. So it's definitely a game that has made its mark.
Stuart, do you have any thoughts on Myst before I begin to wax eloquent?
Yeah, it took me a long time to come around to Myst because I had friends who liked it, who notably all owned Macintosh computers. And it was one of those things where I, like the rest of the gaming press, would make fun of it for essentially being a screensaver. And it's not even a real game. But it turns out that I was in fact wrong, and it is in fact a real game. It's not something that I think I will ever have a particular... a fondness for, because I'm just far too stupid for its puzzles and far too impatient to put the time in to learn them. But, you know, I liked it well enough. I respect it from afar, and I wish it all the best in its future endeavors.
That's a tidy breakup. Yeah, because I am an old, I was just at the right place at the right time for Myst to really intrigue me. I also played it for the first time when I was in college, but unlike Kevin, I was in college when the game came out, having just gotten into college. And as my high school graduation gift, my parents helped me use my summer job earnings to buy a Macintosh computer, terribly underpowered, the cheapest thing they had on the market. But it did have the potential to hook up to a CD-ROM drive, so that was my next big purchase. And I bought a CD-ROM drive and some speakers and a copy of Myst. And it really wasn't like anything else that existed at the time. You know, Doom came out a couple of months later for the first time, but not for Mac. And, you know, I saw people playing that at school, and it seemed intriguing. And it was also that kind of first-person perspective. You're in a virtual world. But it was a very different kind of game, obviously, than Myst. You know, Myst is extremely measured. It can't be fast-paced because it's not a 3D simulation. It is a bunch of 3D renderings presented as screens that are linked together through HyperCard. That's very, very different than John Carmack's custom engine that he built to make PCs go faster than anyone thought humanly possible. It's basically the exact opposite of that. But what Myst did was it took the principles and premises of PC adventure games and stripped away all the hostile stuff. So, you know, unless you got the bad ending in Myst, you couldn't die. And even then you didn't die, you were just trapped. It was really just kind of like you're in a place and there's interesting gigas and gadgets and whizzy things around you. Figure out what they do. And so it was very much about piecing together puzzles and reading clues in books that were scattered around and figuring out how do these things work? How do I portal into other places? And this was, you know, before Super Mario 64 and jumping into paintings to go to other worlds. It was like, you know, here's a book. Now go to the swamp world, go to the machine world, that sort of thing. just very intriguing. You know, in a way, it kind of had the same sort of appeal as Super Mario Brothers on one level, which is that you could kind of take it at your own pace and take the time to poke around and see what was there. And it enticed you to see what was hidden around and what you could connect and combine. And, you know, by simplifying the inventory system, so literally the only thing you could hold at one time was a page of a book and, you know, figure out how that would be used. Everything else was kind of self-contained. It really kind of stripped down the adventure game to get rid of all the red herrings and the misdirection and the cheap deaths and things like that. So I can see where it was very, very appealing. I don't think it has a lot of replay value. But, you know, as an experience in 1993, 94, it was really pretty unprecedented. And the fact that it had these beautiful pre-rendered graphics that, you know, were just... It was like, you know, the virtual reality that you would see in movies. But even though you couldn't move freely through it, it still felt like, oh, they finally brought that to my computer. And that really counted for a lot. So... yeah, I kind of feel like Myst was sort of the step in between games of the 80s and, you know, proper 3D games that would, you know, kind of saturate the market in the coming years. And yeah, it was very much a game of a time and a place. But in that time and place, millions of people bought it and played it. So, you know, it had a huge impact on that level. And even though I don't think it's necessarily aged that well, the impact it had at the time just can't be understated. That's my thought.
But people are still making weird games where you explore a weird space and just collect stuff. And solve puzzles. Mm-hmm. Like that's a format for games to this day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, people have been improving on Myst for decades, and even the Myst games improved on Myst. Mm. All right, so Myst, another big one. Maybe not quite as big as Super Mario Brothers. There's no Myst Wonder coming out this year, but still, you know, it's had its impact. But let's move along to let Kevin have some space. Kevin, what is your first game of wonder?
So on my list, the first thing I put on here was Pac-Man, which seems like a gimme, but that's where my head was at when I was putting this together.
And that is okay.
Yeah. So Pac-Man, moderate success in Japan. It did okay. It really hit when it got exported overseas, when Midway got the license to it. They did not expect it to be the huge hit that it was. None of the companies that were getting it shopped around by Namco did. Oh, yes. And if you can't tell, I recently did a YouTube video about Pac-Man, so all of this stuff is still fresh in my head. But, you know, it came out and it hit pretty hard. You know, they made, I think, more Pac-Man arcade machines than any other game has ever been produced, arcade video game. And it wasn't exactly like anything else out there, which I guess I'll you know, explain a little bit. You know, it wasn't the first maze chase game to be in the coin-op space. It wasn't the first game where you're collecting all the dots. And it's not even necessarily the prettiest game that was out at the time, but the way all the elements came together, it was just very much not like anything else, really, that you could, you know, sit down and throw a quarter in and play. Because you had this game where you're traveling through this maze, you're being chased by these ghosts, and, you know, they're coming for you, and sometimes they sort of back off. There's like a push and pull to how the game plays. And, you know, you can turn the tables on them, of course. That's not too unsurprising. Although maybe in 1980, yeah, late 80, I don't think too many other games were doing that either. So yeah, you had this game and you had the little cutscenes that draw you in, because it's pretty easy to get to the first one, because you just have to clear two levels of the game and it's all the same maze. So it's not like you have to memorize anything new. But that sort of entices you to wonder, okay, well, there must be more of these, surely. And it's a little harder to get to the next one, so that's sort of bringing you in, wanting to play more. You have different bonus items that pop up, and I know for me, when I was younger, this was one of those things where I just wanted to know what the next bonus item was going to be. And it's got this charming art. It's got these great little ditties. I think it really came together at the right time. And like, Pac-Man was huge. There was merchandise out the wazoo for this game at a time when there wasn't really merchandise for video games outside of Japan. And even that was mostly just for Space Invaders. You know, there were books, there was plush toys, there was the awful, awful cartoon. There was records.
How can you say that about the Pac-Man cartoon?
You know, I lived the Pac-Man cartoon. I watched it as a kid, and it was miserable.
Yeah, it kind of sucked.
Yeah, but, you know, I watched it because it was Pac-Man, and Pac-Man's cool, right? So I think this is really sort of the first game that gave you, you know, a character, such as it were, and made you look at that and think, okay, well, this is a marketable character. This is a cool character, even though he doesn't really do anything. Yeah, I'm into this.
Yeah, I like that. I read recently where Pac-Man's designer, Toru Iwatani, said that he sees Pac-Man as basically like id. He doesn't really have a personality. He's just this thing that wants to eat. So, yeah, that's there's been a lot projected onto Pac-Man throughout the various media. But ultimately, he is just a mouth. He just wants to devour. So, you know, it's very relatable, in my opinion.
Yeah, sounds like he's trying to burn me. Nothing interesting about me. I just want to eat. Jeez. What did I ever do to you, Iwatani? We never even met.
I'm just a little mouth kanji guy. It's okay.
Yeah, so I am the right age to, again, have been there for this game's initial impact. I don't remember Pac-Man coming out because my awareness of video games is basically synonymous with my awareness of Pac-Man. But it just seemed like it was everywhere. And, you know, there were Pac-Man board games. We owned one. There were Pac-Man clones. The first video game or electronic game that I ever actually owned was Epoch's Epoch Man, which was a very competent LCD Game & Watch style clone of Pac-Man. Yeah, it was just, it was good times. It was a game, like you said, it really pulled you in. And, It had a very bright colors and personality that you didn't see in other games at the time. And that really it gave it a unique impact, I think.
I want to call Pac-Man toy-like in that I remember even as a child having like little like maze toys you could play with where like you're rolling a ball inside a tiny maze and you're trying to avoid little holes or whatever. And Pac-Man is kind of like a larger version of that, except you're literally controlling the ball and you're doing things you can't possibly do with a toy. Like, no toy could actually have you control a ball collecting other balls. Like, that wouldn't work unless it was made of pure mercury, and that would just, you know, that would be a lawsuit.
Then you would die.
Yeah. So instead it sort of creates this impossible toy-like environment where you're moving one thing and you're being chased by other things. But basically all you're doing is just going around this maze and trying to just reach every corner. That's all you're really doing. You know what I mean? There's no, you know, there is no combat. It's just a matter of evading and running around. And, you know, if you make a choice at the right time, you can turn the tables. But even that, you know, you can only do that so many times.
Stuart, are you going to say something?
I was just going to say, like, I mean, Pac-Man is like a joystick and a single screen. Everything's right there for you. Everything's laid out on the map. It's really obvious what you do from the immediate beginning when Pac-Man starts moving and he starts eating those dots. And you're like, okay, I better eat these dots. Even if you don't know what the premise is, you're going to want to make sure they're all gone. It's so easy to pick up. It's not surprising to me at all that it's stuck around, especially given that mastering it is remarkably difficult. I mean, once you do develop some skill at the game and you start leading the ghosts where you want them to go, it's very satisfying. It's a very definite skill wall that you reach. But overall, it really is just that simple, and pretty much everything they've ever bolted onto this game has made it worse, appreciably. which is why for Pac-Man 2, they had a clean break, and they made it into a little game where you follow Pac-Man around in his life and, like, direct him to things. And
such a great game.
It's such
he has a
great
personality.
Game.
He's not just an eating id.
It really
escapes from the original appeal of Pac-Man, which is that he's nothing but a voracious appetite.
For some reason, I had the official Milton Bradley Pac-Man board game.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to point that out, that isn't really worth seeking out. It's not very good. It's not a very strong translation of Pac-Man.
it was great because there were so many white marbles in that, and inevitably, your mother would get so angry at you because she was vacuuming. Well, this was my experience, and one of those would get caught in the machine and potentially damage the vacuum. So that's the legacy of Pac-Man, the board game, is very unhappy people keeping house.
I think it's quite interesting to look at Pac-Man sort of through the years, how it's gone from like the original absolute like worldwide mega hit, and then it's just them throwing everything at the wall to try and make something work. And you know, you get the Pac-Man World games on the PlayStation or whatever, where you've got like a Patton Oswalt sounding Pac-Man beating up sludge monsters in a sewer. And it's just like, what's happened to you? Like, what's happening here? And then they remembered that people actually like Pac-Man because it's Pac-Man, and they started doing like Champion Edition DX and things like that.
And those were pretty great.
Yeah. I mean, I sort of jumped off the train when we got that CGI Pac-Man cartoon where he would eat the ghost anyway, and then he would lift his little leg up and fart and go like, excuse me. And I just went, nah.
I missed that one.
Yeah. I have a friend who watched that because it was terrible, and that's just, you know, what she does. And she's like, yeah, it was awful, but I couldn't stop watching.
It has stuck in my memory because for that same reason, me and a friend randomly saw one where Pac-Man eats this bean or something and inflates into this massive pimply balloon and flies around. And he's like upset because he's become a meme. Like people have been taking photos of him and turning him into a meme. And he says at one point, like, oh man, I'm a meme. This would be funny if it wasn't so horrible. And I'm like, that's right, Pac-Man. It would be funny if it wasn't so horrible. And that stuck in my head for a long time. I think that became a meme in itself. So that was fun. And that has nothing to do whatsoever with the original Pac-Man. So I regret bringing it up.
Yeah, I think it was Diamond brought up the visual design of the game, and I remember very recently when I was doing my video that so many of the complaints about the Atari version, which is also like the best-selling home game of the 1980s, I don't think anything came close to it until you got to like Mario 3 and Tetris. But anyway, yeah, one of the big complaints lodged against it is that it didn't look or sound like the arcade game, like, and no one expected it to because it was on the Atari, but the fact that it went sort of the opposite direction and had the wrong color palette and didn't even make an attempt at getting the sound design or the music.
And it didn't really play like it at all either, but other than those three things, it was okay.
Yeah, I mean, everyone agreed that the Pac-Man sprite looked pretty good, and that was about it.
Well, I don't really agree with that.
Well, it's not 1982 anymore, so we have other thoughts now.
Yeah, so, Stuart, I think you really hit the proverbial pack nail on the pack head when you were talking about the simplicity and the challenge of it. Mm. Pac-Man really did hit that perfect balance that everyone wanted, that everyone aspired to with arcade game design, which was to create a game that was immediately intuitive at a glance. Like, you knew immediately what you could do: eat things, avoid the little colorful ghosts that are chasing you around. And, you know, eventually they would realize, oh, if I eat the big thing in the corner, then I can chase the ghosts and eat them and turn the tables. And that's really all there is just, you know, figuring out how to avoid those monsters while eating all the dots. Someone, Kevin, was that you, mentioned that Midway didn't realize that Pac-Man was going to be as big a hit as it was. I remember it was shown at the same, I think, AMOA show as Rally X. And everyone was like, oh, Rally X, this is going to be huge because it's so sophisticated and it's about cars and Americans love cars. But if you look, Rally X and Pac-Man are kind of the same thing in that you are a thing moving around in a maze and other things are chasing you. And you have the ability to temporarily turn the tables on the things chasing you. And you have to collect stuff. Mm-hmm. But Rally X is just, it's not as elegant and simple as Pac-Man, because instead of everything being contained in a single screen, it scrolls, and you have to keep track of the enemy race cars using a little radar in the corner. And like, that's very advanced and sophisticated and cool, and it was very, you know, very revolutionary for video games. It was great forward-thinking design, kind of taking the concept of, you know, some of the elements you saw in Defender, the radar screen and everything, and persistence within the stage, and applying those to the maze chase. But it's just not as simple. Like, you turn the tables by using a smoke screen, so it's not as simple as, like, I eat a thing, then I can eat the bad guys. It's, oh, a thing is chasing me, so I can lay down a smoke screen, and it'll spin out if it happens to run into the smoke screen. And how much smoke screen do I have? And you don't have dots everywhere. You just have them in the corner, like various places. They're flags. You just have to think too much to play Rally X. And it's a good game, and I enjoy it, but it's not as, like, it's not the kind of thing you can look at and immediately intuit everything you need to do. And there's a lot of trial and error before you really kind of grasp Rally X. Whereas Pac-Man, it's pretty much, you know, your little guy is going to move until it hits a wall. And then it's up to you to kind of maneuver it with the joystick. And there are no buttons to press. There's no smoke screen. Sometimes a pretzel shows up at the bottom, like, you know, beneath the ghost house. And that's about it.
Just and like real life.
Exactly. Like, get the ghost house pretzel. That's you know, the key to success in all endeavors. That's basically the cornerstone of the Retronauts business. So, yeah, it's just, it really hits that perfect balance of intuitive and emergent complexity. And, you know, even great designers like Nintendo Shigeru Miyamoto can't always do that. I was just reading an article about Skyskipper the other day, and basically everyone agrees, like, you know, this uses the Popeye hardware and it's got a giant monkey like Donkey Kong, but it kind of sucks. It doesn't make sense. Like, it's not intuitive what you're supposed to do. It's like, there's a reason that you've never seen a Skyskipper arcade machine, and that's because it's not that good and no one wanted to play it. Whereas Pac-Man did not have that problem.
Yeah, they really fought the urge to overcomplicate this game. I remember reading one of the development stories from this, is that for a while Pac-Man could shoot. Which
sounds terrible.
Yeah, it sounds like an awful, awful idea. And
my word.
They left it out, thankfully. And like, this game was in development for quite a while, too, for a game of its time. I feel like it was over a year.
Like weeks? Maybe. Oh, really? Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were working on this for a while to like fine tune it and make it play exactly how they wanted it to, and it came out really well. And I think there's something to be said for that, especially on the shooting thing, because I remember there was another game that's one of the many Pac-Man style clones that came out after called Solar Fox, and in the arcade version of that, you have a gun, you can shoot the like enemy turrets and everything that are firing at you. And they took that out of the Atari 2600 port because they only have one button, and they figured speed control was more important than the gun, and it made it a significantly better game. So, yeah, if you're designing a game, don't make it too complicated on yourself.
If you look at Super Pac-Man, which was also designed by Iwatani, to me that's the point, the tipping point, and big time. Like that is a mm-hmm. Pac-Man game that is.
Bad.
You don't need locked doors. You don't need keys to unlock them. You don't need a button to make you go faster. You don't need power pellets and cherries. It's just too much stuff. It's a total perversion of the simplicity of Pac-Man, which is what makes it so good to me. So yeah, they never really hit that again. I mean, you know, you had Ms. Pac-Man, which was, I think all it did was change the maze layouts, had a few more mazes, but it's otherwise fundamentally the same game, right?
It gave you more dynamic ghost patterns. Like they weren't simple patterns anymore. They were more dynamic, so you couldn't memorize a way through every stage the way you could in Pac-Man.
Still better than Super Pac-Man, though.
Oh yeah, most things.
And that one where they added the pinball table to it. I think it was Baby Pac-Man or something.
Baby.
In fairness, that wasn't Namco.
Baby Pac-Man was an idea that could have been really cool if they'd gotten the ghost AI properly done.
Didn't they use the Galaxian board on that instead of Pac-Man?
I think they used the same basic hardware as all of other Midway's games at the time, like Gorf and Wizard of War. I do know that, hilariously, they used the base code of the unreleased Pac-Man port for the Bally Professional Arcade console, because they wrote this up, and then they've learned Atari got the rights to the game, so they're like, oh, well, I guess we can't release this now. And the guy who wrote it was mad, because he was expecting a big payday, just based off of royalties, and so when they asked him if they could just buy his code off him to use as like a base for Baby Pac-Man, he's like, yeah, sure, I'll get paid something for this rather than nothing. And yeah, it's not a very good pinball table. It's not a very good Pac-Man game. And they combine to make something not even as good as either of those.
Mm-hmm. I will say, though, on the subject of sort of Pac-Man being all over the place, I do like Pac-Land quite a lot. I'm quite a big fan of that game. Don't put that out there.
It's like a proto Super Mario Brothers. Like it had to walk so Super Mario could literally run.
Yeah.
Alright, so that's three of us having named one game. We're not going to make it through all five of the selections I suggested everyone put down, but I would like to offer the floor to Stuart for your first pick. I feel like it might be a dark horse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is kind of stretch some people's views of retro, I suppose, but it's not, it is retro. I think Resident Evil 4 has to be mentioned. Like, Resident Evil is one thing, sort of for creating, well, not creating, but sort of codifying survival horror. Because I think that's fair to say, right? Like, there mm-hmm. were survival horror games before it, but that was the one that set the template. And then Resident Evil 4, it set the template again, but for sort of a different genre, which is to say almost every shooting game that has ever released subsequently has followed the lead of this game, more or less. And I guess that the impact is that it's a game that's constantly been re-released on every format since it came out, and that's been bought in swathes at all every time. It's had a remake that has basically almost changed nothing about it. I mean, yes, there are changes, but in terms of its actual mechanics, it's more or less the same exact thing, except you can move now while you're shooting. It's difficult to say, really. It's such a landmark game, coming along and being this total departure from what Resident Evil had been previously. Although, of course, while like Resi 3 did have a more action kind of bent to it, it was still a tank controls, non-dynamic sort of camera angles, pre-rendered backgrounds video game. And that this came along and just, I mean, from my perspective, it changed everything overnight. Everything was suddenly just Resident Evil 4 now. That was now the standard bearer for all third-person shooting. And to be honest, almost all third-person games following that would take their lead from that game. I think that's fair. It being the fact that it came from a GameCube exclusive and still had the impact that it had, it impresses me anyway. I honestly don't even know what else to say about it. It just brought so much to the table that was never there before. It almost seemed to come out of the oven completely fully formed as almost a new genre. And, people will talk about games like Killswitch, which nobody knows or cares about, as having done the third person thing slightly earlier with a similar aiming system. But no, I totally reject that. I think this is a, I think there's a reason why this one is still held up as the pinnacle of the series by most people. And whole flagship games like Gears of War, one of the absolute peak Xbox games, is pretty much the same as Resident Evil 4. Like, in terms of its feel. And you don't get that kind of clout without being a pretty impressive game, I think. I mean, did y'all play Resi 4? I assume you didn't. It's a bit obscure.
I've heard of it.
I didn't, but I watched other people play it.
Okay.
And I've played several of the games that aped it in the years afterwards. So I absolutely agree that this was a surprisingly influential, like, rethink of Resident Evil, and you know, I never really got into the earlier ones because of the tank controls. Just didn't work for me, but this one, like, yeah, I didn't play it myself, but it's so much more fun to, like, hang out with my buddies and watch him go through it because of how dynamic everything moves and how active it is, and also all the great meme-worthy moments involving, was it Chris Redfield in this one?
No,
Leon.
Leon.
Leon, that's right. Leon and Ashley, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, there are so many sort of firsts with this game. It was the first escort-based game I can remember that wasn't intolerable. the way that you could use your pistol or whatever to aim at parts of enemy anatomy, and like, for example, shoot someone in the leg to kneecap them and then run up and kick them in the face. The way that it's
very Terminator 2.
Yeah. The way that everything sort of came together, like, mechanically, to me, is almost unmatched, even by its own sort of sequels, almost especially by its own sequels, to be honest. but things like the, it's very often cited, but, like, that siege on the village at the beginning, like, really, I think that one sequence probably changed video games, like, permanently. It changed expectations of like, I guess, the kind of thriller genre of a video game. You know, I don't remember playing anything like that. The sort of panic that induces, and the way that it's paced is so, I don't like saying movie like, because it makes it sound like it's bad, you know, but it is very cinematic. When you finally think you might maybe have a handle on what you're doing, and then Chainsaw Man turns up, it's a very exciting, game-changing moment. And I hate saying game-changing, but you've made me say it. You, specifically, you've made me say it.
It's so wild to think back, and, you know, the success of the original Resident Evil launched a lot of similar survival horror games for the rest of the 90s. And then, about 10 years later, you have Resident Evil 4, and it somehow reinvents its own genre and creates an even larger number of clones.
Well, I guess one way of putting it, and I may be wrong about this and people can correct me, is once Resident Evil 4 was made, how many pre-rendered fixed-angle horror games happened after that? You know, I mean, that weren't specifically nostalgic throwbacks. They changed the entire, it changed everything.
Right.
They were like, right, that's finished now. We're not doing that anymore. We have to be like this now.
Like, fans go back to make the old games now because so many games are Resident Evil 4. It's like, no, wait, I want to do the old Resident Evil game. But it's like, so it's like, it's become a statement to not do this game.
But, and of course, what it also did, in a sense, is it divided, it's something that you very rarely see. It split the series into two different sort of forms, which are both equally beloved. And kept sort of going in a way with, especially sort of with re-releases, because like the Resident Evil remake on the GameCube and now on everything is held up as one of the greatest survival horror games of its type. And Resident Evil 4 is also held up as one of the greatest survival horror games of its type, and never the twain shall meet within the same series canonically. That's very unusual. Very, very unusual, I think.
I am deeply indifferent to anything horror based aside from the movie Alien. And,
well, you don't like being scared by a monster.
No, I mean, I've got enough anxiety in life. I don't need to deal with
fair
that.
Enough. Yeah, fair enough.
No, Resident Evil has never done anything for me. But I do remember when this game came out. And, you know, in the run-up, the lead-up to its release, I think there was a lot of resistance to it and a lot of resentment over how different it was from the previous games. Mm-hmm. Kind of like Metroid Prime, where people were like, this is never going to work as a first-person shooter. And then it came out and people were, you know, immediately ate crow. Resident Evil 4 was very much the same. Like, there was real ill feeling among fans, as I recall, and on, you know, forums and communities, that Capcom had just totally sold out, lost their way, had no idea what they were doing. The series was dead. And I remember the review copy came in, and Matt Leone, 1UP's, what was he at the time, like features editor? No, that was me. He was the Xbox editor, I guess, and did some other stuff. Whatever the hell Matt was, he was the guy who reviewed it and reviewed a lot of games of this style. And I remember he could not stop playing this game, and he just kept gushing about how good it was. And, like, you know, for an entire week or two, every time I looked at his desk, he was just playing this game way longer than he needed to in order to review it. It was just, he just kept playing it. And even though it didn't really do anything for me, I could tell, like, oh, this is something different. This is something special. This is really going to catch on with people. Like, he's a pretty... like, he has very specific tastes, and it's hard to impress Matt. So the fact that he just absolutely adored this game and could not stop playing really spoke well to it. And
I didn't like Resident Evil until I played this game. I wasn't into the old ones for similar reasons to Kevin. I couldn't get on with the controls and such. Nowadays, I'm okay with them. Something's changed in my head. But the point is, I didn't get this game until quite late. I got it for PlayStation 2, which is the worst version by some distance. And it was like from a charity shop for like nothing. Like, I got it really cheap from a thrift store, and I was like, fine, I guess I'll give this game a go. Because I was resistant to it as well, because it was Resident Evil. It was not my thing. And I ended up just like playing it solidly. Whenever I'd go out, I'd want to come home and play it. I'd be like jonesing for it. Then when, of course, the remake came around, I was like, there's no way this is going to be as good as the original. And it kind of is. It kind of is as good as the original. And of course, they've just dropped the downloadable content for that separate ways, which is a take on something that was in the PlayStation version, a separate campaign. And, you know, as soon as that came out, I was straight on that until it was over. It's a game that's got a real pull on me and you know, many, many others, mostly because it's so, you can be so creative in it. You can be so responsive to situations. You're not locked in. Like, there's never one true technique that's always going to work for you, because something unexpected might happen. Or you might get a cluster of enemies and think, oh, hang on a second. If I flash grenade here, that kills two of these pluggers creatures, but it leaves these three things alive. But if they're then stunned, if I run around here and kick this guy, he's going to knock those two over, and I can get to that ladder and get out of here, kick the ladder down so they can't follow me. It's very... I don't know how to describe it, but you're very in control, you know? Even though you do have quite stiff controls, everything you do is conducive to changing the situation in your favor or against it. It's all on you. You can screw up. You can use the environment against the enemies if you're clever. And the fact that it has sort of movement limitations makes that all the clearer. You're never scrabbling with sort of like, can I do this? Because it's always very clear whether or not you can. And I really like that a lot. It works big time. It's a fantastic game.
All right, so that's round one for us. I feel like this is... kind of turning into, this was not my intention, but maybe it's unavoidable, just kind of like a recap of a lot of episodes that we've already recorded. And that's okay. Sometimes, you know, a clip show is just what the writer's strike ordered. Mm-hmm. But let's move on to a second round, and maybe we'll start with Diamond this time, and maybe look at this list you've compiled and pick the least expected thing on here, or, you know, something that we haven't necessarily talked about a whole lot in recent years. Mix things up a little, I guess, is what I'm saying. And I'm going to try to do the same as well. So, Diamond, I will let you kick off this round.
Well, looking at my list, I would think if we're doing Black Sheep, Oddball, Outsider Choices, I'm going to go with Dragon's Lair. Because Dragon's Lair is a game that, your first at first glance, you think about like, oh, no one makes games like that, and everyone that game had its moment and it was very popular, but then everyone agreed it was not the right way to go. But I think Dragon's Lair was interesting because Dragon's Lair exploded because it took advantage of new technology to sort of circumvent the problem that video games were having, which was that storage and memory and graphics, all these things that you wanted to put in your video game, you couldn't fit them in there. So like they used this new technology. It's like, okay, we're going to have an entire cartoon made by a man who makes very impressive cartoons, and we're going to let the player play a cartoon, you know? Earlier someone said, you know, someone made a comment about, oh, Super Mario Brothers looks like a cartoon. No, Dragon's Lair was actually a cartoon. And admittedly, it does this by sort of restricting gameplay to a very limited sort of number of choices. Like as the cartoon plays, you have to push a joystick or push a button to make the next cartoon play. And if you don't do it right, then a different cartoon plays and your character dies and you have to try it again. So it's kind of an unfair game. And once you know what to do, there's no reason to play it anymore. But the reason I put it on here is because I think years and years later, when the technology caught up with things and people could just put, you know, have a CD or a Blu-ray and just stuff, or DVD, and just stuff all the data on there, people started having these really expensive, detailed graphical experiences where you were suddenly pushing up or pushing the punch button at the right time to trigger a new animation. And it got us the QTE, and it got us interactive cutscenes, and it got us, you know, Heavy Rain. And yeah, okay, a lot of the stuff I'm mentioning is kind of bad, but what my point is that this game that came out in, I want to say, 84, was a leap into the future and showed us what kind of things we could do with more storage and more technology. And I think the nuts and bolts of Dragon's Lair are still peppered throughout all the AAA games that do this kind of stuff right now, where you have to, you know, press F to pay respects. You know, it's like, you must pay respects to Dragon Lair, because Dragon's Lair did it first.
Oh, man, I remember the first time my wife, we were dating at the time, we went to an arcade, and they had Dragon's Lair and Space Ace, which is the other game that Don Bluth worked on around the same time.
You guys were dating in 84? How old are you?
No, we were dating in like 20... This was 2015, I think, we went to this arcade.
It was a retro arcade. Ah,
yes.
Okay.
Yes.
All right, I'm not calling the cops.
And they somehow had two laser discs that were working, and they had both those games. And I remember she was looking at these, and she was like, wow, this looks incredible. How come more games don't like look like this? This is so cool. And I imagine that's what the reaction was back when this game came out. We didn't sit down and play it for like 2 months until we'd mastered it, obviously, because that would have answered that question. But yeah, I remember this was really seen at the time as like the big savior of the coin-op space, because it was kind of falling apart from oversaturation at the time. And, you know, that didn't pan out, but it sure looks cool. And it's actually a really neat little game to play in short bursts, as long as you're not trying to completely master it.
I mean, would it be fair to say, and it probably isn't fair to say, so feel free to correct me, video games as they are, like, they'd been around in a popular sort of form for, what, 4 years at this point? So maybe it's not necessarily been sort of, you know, nailed down exactly what a game should be like or how a game should feel. And the fact that Dragon's Lair has this quite stiff Simon sort of based gameplay, maybe it didn't matter quite so much, you know? Like, it's going to get a lot of scorn nowadays, obviously, but maybe back then the spectacle was more worth it than the... I don't know. Given that you would be paying to play it, which you would likely not be, at least in the same way nowadays, it's going to somewhat ironically seem less, like, impressive. Is that... I don't know how to explain. I mean, is that fair to say that maybe they didn't have the same understanding of what a game should be? You know, in 83, I mean, obviously there were lots of games that existed by then.
I mean, there's a whole argument, like a whole theological argument when you say what a game should be, because I don't think there's any like fixed definition.
No, I just mean that like with Dragon's Lair coming out and, you know, retrospective content being like, oh, it's barely a game, it's just sort of a QTE sort of thing. Like, did that really matter? Does it matter exactly how you play this game? Does it really write it off as crappy because of that? I mean, for me, the memorization kind of hurts it, but when you play the game nowadays, you're going to probably be playing one of the versions that shows you what you're supposed to press, which I imagine the original one didn't. Apart from some occasional flashes on the screen. So watching someone play this who was skilled at it, aka remembered what to do, back in the day, it really would look like they're pretty seamlessly playing a cartoon, whereas now you play it and it looks like you're playing a QTE.
Right.
You know? I think that changes the context of it a bit. That's just, yeah, thoughts.
Yeah, for me, the cost of the game was a huge deterrent at the time because it cost twice as much as any other arcade game. You had to put in two quarters as opposed to one, and you could die pretty quickly. Like, you'd see the intro sequence and then immediately you were thrust into the action. And if you didn't intuit what you were supposed to do, you'd get three chances, three quick screw ups. You'd get three death animations and you're at 50 cents. So that was like the trade-off there was not appealing to me. I could play so much more Moon Patrol or Elevator Action on 50 cents than I could Dragon's Lair. So the accessibility of it now is actually much more interesting to me. And I mean, they've released Dragon's Lair as just a DVD that you control with the remote controls, like direction buttons. It's a video game that doesn't even need a video game system to run on, which... You know, this is pre-Java and whatever. That's actually very interesting. And I can understand, even though I don't really like Dragon's Lair that much, like, I can see why it resonated so intensely with people at the time and made such a huge impression and continues to be reissued in ways that other Laserdisc-based games just don't. I mean, there were so many Laserdisc action games in the early 80s that kind of coasted on Dragon's Lair's success, but this is the only one that really has any traction or mindshare.
I think Taito is putting out Time Gal and one of their other ones on Switch reasonably soon, as of this timing. But so hopefully that will lead to a resurgence and we'll get like Who Shot Johnny Rock and Mad Dog McCree on the Switch.
Yeah, I feel like Time Gal and Ninja Hayate, just because they were out on the Sega CD in the early 90s, probably got a lot of mindshare at the time. Like, not compared to Dragon's Lair, of course, but...
I mean, the Mega CD was an entire system that was founded on the basis of playing these games, wasn't it? Like, FMV games was pretty much the marketing draw
It became the marketing draw pretty quickly for it, because that was, like, the hot time for
FMVs. No one was there for Wonder Dog, like, at all, so...
I mean, do you really want to play Sonic CD?
That game sucks.
Oh, my God.
I'm just joking there. Another thing that I think... We should mention, I think this was kind of touched on briefly, but the animation was headed up by Don Bluth, who, you know, is a great animator, but to really kind of put yourself back into the context of the times of the early 80s, you have to remember that Disney was kind of in a bad way at the time. They'd drifted away from animation. Their most recent animations hadn't really been big hits. They'd been things like, you know, The Rescuers and Lady and the Tramp, and I think I might be getting my history scrambled, but you know, the early 80s, they did stuff like The Sword and the Stone and The Black Cauldron, and those weren't successes. They felt dated and old, and the studio was kind of dissolving. Its animation division was splintering, and Don Bluth, who was one of the kind of like cornerstone animators for Disney, who helped make them such a big deal in the 60s and, you know, made their animation studio so remarkable, struck out on his own. So you had like one of the powerhouses of Disney's talent creating his own studio, and his movies for a while, things like the Secret of Nim and what else was there? I don't know. Some of his other stuff.
Did he do American Tail?
Yes, that's
eventually.
Right.
Yeah.
Those actually, you know, fared better than Disney before The Little Mermaid kind of sparked a revival for the company's animation. So having a video game animated, like a cartoon by one of Disney's greats, that was really a huge draw. Like, there was a lot of hype around Don Bluth as an entity. So for him to kind of spearhead this video game, it wasn't just a draw for the arcade, but it said, wow, video games are a serious medium that have managed to pull in this legendary talent. And, you know, he's focused his time and attention on creating this video game experience. So this must be something worthwhile and good. I think that's kind of overlooked these days because Disney came back and Don Bluth kind of tapered off. But at the time, it really was, you know, he was fresh off The Secret of NIMH and just, you know, it just felt like this was the future of animation. Like, animation's going to become interactive and you're going to be able to play cartoons from now on, which is not the way things worked out exactly, but that's really how it felt. So, yeah, like, that's a big part of Dragon's Lair's mindshare, just the fact that it kind of represented this idea of what might happen with animation and video games converging in the future. And, you know, it really stuck with people. Like, there was a lot of buzz around it. It was something that pushed into the mainstream in a way that, you know, previously only Pac-Man and Donkey Kong and Space Invaders had done, I think. And yeah, that sticks with people. So I think that has a big part, has a lot to do with its enduring legacy. Any other thoughts on Dragon's Lair?
Dragon's Lair 2 kind of sucks.
Yeah, Space Ace, don't love it.
Space Ace is okay.
I mean, I think one problem with Dragon's Lair, with how much it sucks, is like, the fact of the matter is, if you go and you play the games that were made under the same name, that were actual, like, air quotes, actual games, they kind of suck just as bad, if not worse, mm-hmm. but in a different way.
The fact that they tried to make this game for NES, just the audacity amazes me. That was so ballsy.
Horrible game.
All right, so let's move along to Kevin. Kevin, what's your dark horse cornerstone of video games, the enduring legacy of an unexpected title? Lay it on us.
I'm going with the most left field one I have on here, and that is Star Trek, the 1971 computer game by Mike Mayfield.
Is that does that game have an enduring commercial legacy?
Commercial, to an extent, mm-hmm. but I chose it mostly because it has a very enduring legacy in terms of influence and how far afield it got. So this was a game by a high school student named Mike Mayfield. He wrote it at a nearby college that he had gotten through illicit means a key pass into their computer lab, but he did not have access, like, programming access to their good computer, the one that could run Space War. He only had access to one that had a teletype display, so he was thinking to himself, okay, how can I make a space combat type of game with a teletype, which is basically just a printer that's printing up what's going on the screen. So he came up with this very fascinating and very, like, forward-thinking game where you are commanding the Enterprise and you're required to travel around a star map, travel to different sectors and look for Klingon ships and get into fights with them and destroy them all. And you have to do this within a set time limit.
Has this game never heard of the Kitamura Accords? What the hell?
It has not. This is such an interesting game to me because, you know, so many things sort of pull out of it. This was the this game had seeds. You know, every time you loaded it up, you put in a different number, and that would generate what the game map would look like and where everything would be located.
Space seeds.
Yeah, space seeds. Yeah, later versions of it, because this game, spoiler alert, it got picked up the following year. He reprogrammed it and submitted it to HP for their program database, and it spread from there to basically every other computer platform on Earth for the next, like, 20 years. Like, you can find versions of it on Japanese computers, European computers, there's probably Russian computer versions of it. And it was, it got republished in David Ahl's 101 Basic Computer Games book, because there was a version of it someone had written up for the DEC PDP computers that he had been working with. So it just got everywhere. And I remember I interviewed someone who wrote Super Star Trek, which was the first big tweak to the game.
Is that the one where the Enterprise can get a super mushroom and get big and shoot fireballs?
Sure. Yeah, we'll go with that. There's probably a version of the game that has that, because, like I said, there's like a million of them, and people always like
eat a space mushroom and it turns into the Enterprise D.
Eat a space mushroom and you have to fight the Doomsday Machine.
I mean, space mushrooms is definitely a plot line from a classic episode, so I'd believe it.
Absolutely. But yeah, so this is a game that that touched so many people that played this, and there were a few versions of it that were made like commercially, usually without the Star Trek license. Like there's like three or four of them on the Commodore 64 and the Spectrum, just alone, and practically every other computer. There's a version for the Cosmac VIP. There's a version for the Famicom Disk System and the Atari 2600.
I played this game in the 80s. On my uncle's portable K-Pro with a three-line LCD screen. Yep. So, yeah, trying to get those star maps in three lines of text, not really working.
And, you know, Star Raiders came out of this game very, very directly. And Star Raiders influenced a ton of other games, like Wing Commander and what have you. But, what I was saying is that the guy who made Super Star Trek, I interviewed him a while back, and we were talking about this, and, like, the legacy of the game, and he told me that for about, since he published the Super Star Trek version in, like, 76, he'd gotten letters from people all over the globe, just, like, asking him for, like, programming tips for making the game work on their hardware, and, giving him, feedback and everything, and I think that's just wildly fascinating to me. Like, this may not have had a commercial legacy because it was a public domain piece of software, but it had a legacy in terms of teaching people how to program, how to make their own games, how to do like cool stuff with this as their starting point.
This was the Velvet Underground of video games. I got it.
Yeah, except everyone heard of it at the time.
Never a commercial hit.
It would be the Velvet Underground if the reason they never did a commercial hit is because they just gave all their music away, I guess.
Hmm.
But the fact that like it was so widespread, I feel like anyone who used a computer up through the 90s probably has messed with this game. And yeah, it's a personal favorite, even though I didn't discover it until the 2000s.
So this is very interesting because I kind of envisioned this discussion being about games that had huge mind share among kind of, the general public. But this is kind of the opposite of that. But it gets into an aspect of video games that I think we don't really discuss all that much on the show and has largely subsided and been forgotten, which is that, before the big arcade breakout era of the early 80s, there was a mindset that video games and just technology in general should be shared freely. And kind of getting into this non-commercial, kind of for the good of society approach to game design and sharing. It was such an essential part of video game history and really kind of established so much of what we think of when we think of video games today. But it's largely been forgotten because, there is no sort of central repository of this material. It's not like you can go and jump on eBay and find, like the Tandy version of Star Trek by Mike Mayfield. You can find its derivatives maybe, but not the actual game itself. So yeah, that's something I hadn't really considered when I put this topic together, but that is one of the reasons I wanted you on, Kevin, because you're so good about highlighting things that the rest of us may not be, might not necessarily have in mind. So, thanks for bringing this in. But I don't want to you know, suffocate the conversation here if Stuart or Diamond have things to say about Star Trek, the 1971 Mike Mayfield game, by all means, jump in.
I don't think I'd even heard of it, to be honest. I think I'm the one who didn't know what this was. Nor have I seen much Star Trek, I'm sorry. I have played Elite Forces, that's pretty fun.
I was say, this was made by a Star Trek nerd, but I don't think it really has much to do with the actual show.
I've played Super Star Wars. It sucks.
Yeah, I could talk for 5 hours about actual Star Trek, but I'm afraid this is one I never actually experienced. So I'm excited to hear that this sort of, you know, fan-made, completely unauthorized 1971 video game has a lasting legacy that's even today. That's exciting for me.
I think it's interesting that fans find their way to do this, because there's a fairly well-known, very early Doctor Who game called Daleks, which was fan-made, where it's just increasing number of Daleks and increasing number of moves for the Doctor, and every time you move, they move. And it sounds on a similar vein to that, except obviously more strategic. It's just interesting that sci-fi fans will find a way to make their thing appear on a computer. You know, that's nice. It makes me happy.
There was a huge amount of influence from Star Trek in the early 70s gaming scene. There was one of the first, maybe the first multiplayer strategy games, network strategy games, was called Empire. And if you actually look at the graphics, it has, you know, the Enterprise on the title screen. So it's a Star Trek themed space turn-based strategy game, I believe, that you know, you could network and play against other people. And it's not officially Star Trek, but it's all over there. And even, you know, even Space War, they have the rocket ship, and then they have the ship that's kind of sort of the Enterprise, like kind of based on that paradigm. So yeah, like the whole syndication thing, there's like, that's a whole separate discussion that we actually probably should have as a podcast sometime. But yeah, it's the impact of Star Trek on video games is pretty profound. Yeah. And this is, I would say, by far the most significant instance of that, because its design and approach has been so influential. I mean, you know, Star Citizen and Starfield, like those are games that exist now, or I guess Star Citizen will exist at some point after maybe another $60 million of cash.
Sort of exists.
Yeah. But I mean, those are games that have, like, they can trace their origins back to this text game in a lot of ways.
My favorite anecdote about how different things were in the 70s is that when David Ahl was putting together his book and he wanted to include this, he ran into Gene Roddenberry at a convention and told him, like, oh, hey, I have this game. It's based on Star Trek, but I can't call it Star Trek in the book. Could I get, like, a license to do that? And Roddenberry said, sure, let me go talk to someone. And, like, a few days later, he got a letter in the mail saying, oh, yeah, you are officially allowed to use Star Trek, the name, for your game in this book. So if you look at the book of it, I think it's the second printing of it. It's officially under the title Star Trek, and he didn't pay a dime for it. Whereas nowadays, you would spend probably millions of dollars and get a mediocre game out of that effort.
Yeah. Again, there needs to be an original series episode at some point. I don't want to turn this into that. But like that kind of fan legacy and kind of enthusiasts keeping the brand alive, the storylines alive, was just part of the background radiation of my childhood. And it's really hard to describe to people who weren't there at the time. But there was just this kind of, if you were sort of a nerd and you liked to read a lot and thought space was neat, like, you were going to interact with Star Trek stuff in some capacity, even though Star Wars was the new hotness. And that, you know, traces its origins back to the 60s and especially the 70s. And here it is in video games. Anyway, let's move along. Stuart, what is your Do you have a dark horse? Ooh, I see a big dark horse on here that I don't think we've really talked about on the show, but I don't know if you want to talk that one or something else.
I was free choice here. I wanted to talk about ZZT because of the sort of user creation aspect of it, but I feel like Kevin has covered that to some extent with Star Trek. And ZZT, I think I have scope to, you know, do a full episode about at some
point. So that's not ZZT or ZZTED or something. It's ZZT.
I get, I always call it ZZT, but I mean, I think it's actually just ZZT. I think it's meant to be pronounced, but it'll be ZZT to me. But I think I want to talk about Super Meat Boy in a sense because I feel like it made the indie scene a thing, in a sense, because there are so many things it sort of brought together. For those who aren't familiar with this, is I want to say 2008. This is Edmund McMillan, Team Meat. Edmund McMillan has a way of not to get, you know, slanderous here, but he has a way of eradicating partnerships that he's in, I think. But so Team Meat sort of isn't him anymore, but it was then. Anyway, Super Meat Boy was spawned from a game on Newgrounds called Meat Boy, which was a fairly simple but quite dynamic platform game, which got expanded into Super Meat Boy on consoles, which was interesting because it felt, though I think it was Microsoft published, it felt very underground because not only is it this quite gross, bizarre, hyper difficult game that brings over the kind of the Kaizo Mario thing. You know, you're constantly dying. It's really, really absurdly difficult, but Massacre, I think they call it now. You die in this game, you come back in like less than 1 second. You're just straight back in for another attempt, another failed attempt. And it was the first game I can think of on major consoles or even on major paid sort of release that did that. And not only did it do that, did it bring that sensibility to sort of modern gaming, but it also had this cast of unlockable characters who were all of these characters from indie games who at that time weren't necessarily that well known, and some of them still aren't that well known. Like, for example, you'd get Commander Video from the Bit Trip games. This was at the time we were exclusive indie games starring this little black visored character that would go through these kind of obtuse arty sort of these video games, and this wasn't really arty at all, but in bringing him and say Ogmo from Jumper, which is one of Maddie Thorson's early games, not even a paid game, a freeware PC game that had got mindshare among enthusiasts and now was being brought out into this much bigger world, I think it sort of created indie games as a identity. And I think it's stuck around since then, thanks to being a genuinely very good platform game. I believe, like, you've got the main character from the game Mighty Jolof is in this, and that no one even remembers that game at the time. At the time, it was a reasonably popular. Everybody remembers that game, but it's a game that people don't really talk about anymore because it never, like, it didn't come to Steam. I don't think it was just a free, slightly obscure indie PC game that you could get, and now it was out there on every PC in the country thanks to Super Meat Boy. And get indie games since this, it's almost like they got this sort of energy to go, hey, wait a minute, we can be really, really hard, and that can be our whole thing. And, you know, that gives birth to, again, a much broader sort of speedrunning community, as people want to see these games taken to pieces. So you end up with things like Awesome Games Done Quick, where this kind of gameplay is being recreated live for enormous charity donations. And, you know, the fact that this game was also offering a sort of marketplace with a level editor for people to give their own stages, and then Meat Boy comes forward and starts turning up on loads of other people's indie games, and then indie games start to introduce secret characters from other indie games constantly, and you start to feel like indie has become something much bigger, and it had become something much bigger, and I think that Meat Boy is the game that kind of kicked that off. But I'm prepared to argue about it if anyone wants to disagree.
No, I'm with you on this. Super Meat Boy, like, it, I know there were earlier indie games because obviously so many of the characters that were hidden in Super Meat Boy stem from other indie games, but I think this is the one that really sort of solidified the language of them, and I think it was probably one of the biggest hits as far as indie games go, of its time, and it didn't have the awful guy who made Braid involved with it, so that's a big bonus.
Jonathan Blow, yeah. Yeah, it didn't, although I think you could play as Braid in the game, so let's brush that one under.
I think one of the versions of it had him in there, yeah.
Well, but we didn't know back then. We didn't know at the time, okay. I think that I think Jonathan Blow is one of those guys where you just have to play the games and not think about the things that he said, but alternatively, you just do neither.
But I do enjoy... that they have the kid from I Want to Be the Guy in there, and that, like, and that all of these stages for all these hidden characters are sort of like based around those games that they come from, but in a like very Super Meat Boy-esque style. So in his case, it's probably you just have these like really brutally designed levels, but there's no gacha traps in them, which is so much better than I Want to Be the Guy.
Yeah.
So I think that's sort of my big takeaway from Super Meat Boy, is that it sort of pushed this idea that you can have a game that's hard, but it's hard, like, on its face. It's not doing anything to actively screw you over like a Kaizo hack or a, or I Want to Be the Guy. It's,
I think it's interesting because, you know, Ogmo from Jumper, and Jumper was this freeware game by what was at the time Helix Games and is now known to be Maddie Thorsen, who made Celeste. And without Meat Boy, I do wonder whether or not they would have had the sort of exposure to do things like Towerfall and to do things like Celeste, because they it was sort of like, oh, hey, that's the developer from that game that's in Super Meat Boy. I know that Fly Wrench was a sort of very unknown one that turned up on Steam eventually, and the only reason I bought it is because I went, oh, hey, that's from Meat Boy, that's probably pretty good.
Yep,
I feel like it almost became this hub for a bunch of indie games that previously maybe wouldn't have been quite so popular. I mean, they were popular to an extent to be in there at all, but like, I wonder how many people saw Ogmo and went, oh, what the hell is that? I'm going to have to go and look this game up.
That was me. That was me. That was wondering what the heck Ogmo was.
Yeah, I would say, you know, the rise of indie games was kind of a bunch of things happening at once, like Geometry Wars landing on Xbox 360. Spelunky happened around the same time as Super Meat Boy, but it was this game was definitely a big part of that and really did shape game design. I mean, Super Mario Odyssey even kind of did away with lives, and even though it's not a super hard game in the way that Super Meat Boy is, it was the point at which even, you know, the series that Super Meat Boy was obviously ripping off or riffing on with its title SMB said, oh, that's a good idea. We should do like that game did. So, yeah, it's concepts have worked its way back into, you know, the most mainstream and popular franchises imaginable. So that's quite remarkable. It's design. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I looked up to be sure. You compare Super Meat Boy with something like V.
Yeah.
I hope I said the right number. It's V's. But
I believe it's called the letter V six times. That's the official title.
Right. But those are both 2010 releases. And people play the V game. People love the V game.
Oh,
but
yeah.
That didn't have the outreach or the impact that Super Meat Boy did. Super Meat Boy was a massive influence on so many other games. You know, you don't see a lot of V clones, you know?
Yeah, VVV, sorry, the letter V six times was a freeware. I think it was paid, actually. It was a straight up indie. I don't think it was on Steam at launch. I don't think it was on any consoles at launch. And Meat Boy, I think, launched on Xbox. I don't think it launched on PC at the same time.
I think that's right. I think the PC version came, 6 months later
or
something.
It was part of Summer of Arcade, I think they used to do back in the day.
Sounds right.
Where it was four exclusives would launch, and you know, nobody cares what the other three were. Lost the time. But I mean, even Spelunky at this point, I don't think had come out as its big remake yet. It was still its freeware version, and the Spelunky guy is in Super Meat Boy, which is one of the things that made me go, well, I should probably check out Spelunky. I knew it existed because I was reading PC Gamer, but and they were gushing about it constantly. But I just think of Super Meat Boy as this hub for that scene that really, I think, brought it a lot of prominence. I think without Super Meat Boy, you don't get, you know, stuff like, I know it involves Jonathan Blow, but like Indie Game the Movie pivots around that game. It gives a lot of insight into the scene, makes it a lot more I guess, mainstream in a sense. And then you sort of end up getting three layers, which is that you get, you know, the mainstream games on the top, you get indie games that are mainstream, and then you get stuff that's on, you know, itch and doesn't have a Steam release, and that becomes the new indie. So I don't know. I think it was a big shift for everything, personally.
All right, so let's wrap this episode with my second pick. I feel like we need to do another one of these at some point, unless everyone on Discord is like, wow, that episode sucked ass, don't ever do that again, because we still have a lot of ground to cover that we did not get to touch on. But, you know, in terms of games that were a huge hit at the time, had a massive impact, and are still viable products, the next thing that came to mind for me was Tetris. And I mean, like Super Mario Brothers, there was a movie about that recently. And also, like Super Mario Brothers, I don't think that was a very good movie.
Pac-Man got a movie. It was called Pixels. I hear it was tremendous.
Yes. Oh, that's true. Yes. Qbert was in there too. But yeah, Tetris is one of those that is maybe, of all the games we've discussed here, the most pervasive, the most mainstream, the most baked into popular culture, even in ways that people don't think about, because it transcended, you know, the idea of, oh, I don't play video games, because people who didn't play video games still wanted to play Tetris. It is one of those games that is so elegant, so simple, you know, like Pac-Man, it's immediately intuitive what you have to do and how to play it. And yet actually getting really good at it takes a lot of practice. But even more so than Pac-Man or Myst, you know, these games that really work their way outside of the gamer sphere, Tetris worms its way into your brain and makes you want to keep playing it. And it's really like there's been research on its addictive qualities and how it has, like, you know, causes the same sort of chemical triggers in your brain as something like methamphetamine or something. It's just so simple and so addictive in, you know, not necessarily a bad way, but it just, it's, there's something about it that just clicks with the human brain and just really insinuates itself there and keeps you going. And they've, you know, tried to improve on Tetris over the years, not often with success. They've kind of locked down the rule set for Tetris, which I feel is a huge mistake. I really enjoy the older Tetris games where things were a little more freewheeling and it wasn't like you have to have, you know, free spin and, you know, like a frame or two of time before a block locks into place, yada, yada, yada. Like, you know, there's hard, fast, rigid laws now about how Tetris is allowed to play. But it doesn't need to be like that. Just the premise of it is so, like, there's a lot of flexibility in how it's interpreted, and yet it's always good. Even when the controls are weird, like on the Famicom version, it's still good and very, very compelling. So, yeah, you know, I can't really put a finger on where Tetris first truly entered the public mind.
I guess it was Game Boy version, surely.
Maybe, but I mean, the NES version, I think, came out before that, and it got a lot of hype. And, you know, there were two versions, and that got a lot of discussion. And even before that, you know, there was an arcade version, there were computer versions. Like, it kind of eased its way into public awareness. And yeah, Game Boy was definitely kind of the watershed moment for it, I think. But, you know, people who were playing video games and computer games and, you know, went to arcades, saw this and were like, ooh, this is interesting. So it had kind of a build up to that Game Boy moment. And I don't think that Hank Rogers actually had to go and sneak into Hiroshi Yamauchi's office and say, hey, you know how cool it is when Little Mac punches Mike Tyson? That's what Tetris is like. No, that's not true. It's a self-evident thing, I think.
Well, I want to share my Tetris story because I really do feel like the Game Boy version is the major flashpoint here, because I remember, like, I got a Game Boy for my bar mitzvah, and I definitely played a lot of Tetris. But in playing Tetris, I would hear stories from other people who were also playing Tetris. And one of the wilder ones was a few years later, so like early 90s, when my parents had split up, my dad was in a relationship with this woman. I don't know how old she was, but she was, you know, an adult like my dad. And she would tell me that her father, who I don't know how old this man was, but, you know, she's an adult. Her father, got to be at least 60, 70 years old, was obsessed with Tetris. And to me, as a teenager, I'm like, wait, you can play video games that old? Like, I had never occurred to me that you could do that. Meanwhile, I'm closer to that age than I am teenage now. But still, the point is that Tetris became this phenomenon that seemingly no one could escape. And once it was on that portable machine, it was very easy to get your hands on it. And it was very hard to wrest them from your hands once these people started playing. So I think Tetris on Game Boy not only helped made the Game Boy huge, but Tetris itself somehow eclipsed all generations and genders and nationalities and probably species. There's probably animals out there playing Tetris. We just don't know about it because they can't talk.
Hmm. Jane Goodall needs to report back to us. I think a big part of Tetris's enduring legacy also has to do with its absolute simplicity. Even more so than Pac-Man, all you need to play Tetris is, you know, basically a D-pad, one button. Like, this doesn't have to be a good version of Tetris. You just need left and right and one button. That's a sucky version of Tetris, but you can do it. And you need a grid of pixels that is, what, like 11 high and 25 tall or something like that? Or 11 wide and 25 tall? However many pixels it is. That's a very small pixel grid. You could almost do this on the Milton Bradley Microvision, and that's really saying something. That's all you need. And, you know, in the years where the NES had waned and they were coming out with Tetris 2 and Tetris Plus and blah, 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 the original Tetris was still showing up off of video game systems as like little LCD keychains that you could buy for $10. And it was something you could just pick up and play anytime. There were freeware clones of Tetris, you know, sometimes very faithful. Sometimes they were like, but what if we added a piece that had 5 blocks instead of 4? Wouldn't that make Tetris better? No, actually it would not. but people had to experiment with this and, you know, make these mistakes to kind of hone in on the fact that Tetris itself is perfect and you cannot improve on it, but you don't need to improve on it because it is such a game, you know, so exquisite and so playable that the original version of Tetris, you know, the original iteration, the concept is something that, you know, people can just continue to enjoy on and on. And that's amazing. That's really remarkable. That's a rare work of video game genius.
Yeah, this is one of those games that, like you said, it can run on practically anything. There's demakes of Tetris on so many old pieces of hardware. It's been ported around probably as many times as Doom at this point. And really mechanically, it's pretty straightforward. Like, you can do like weird stuff with it. I know there's the Tetris, the Grandmaster games have a big fan base. Of folks who are really, really into Tetris and really like that, the way that does things.
I think but Arika is the only company that's allowed to do weird variant things with Tetris that stray from the Tetris Bible at this point, because they do such a good job of making it bizarre.
And even then, they're on a pretty like short leash as far as like how often and on what platforms they can put that out on. But yeah, at this point, it's like, okay, well, if I want to play Tetris, here's some basic rule sets. Maybe if you're lucky, you can get a little weird with them. And beyond that, it's just aesthetics. Like, what does this version of Tetris look like? What does it sound like? And you know, you were talking about the Game Boy version, and I think having that packed in with the Game Boy was a stroke of genius. Not just in terms of like getting Game Boys into people's hands, but in terms of just getting Tetris out there, because it was. They sort of fed off of each other, like, okay, here's a portable game system that's actually really good. Here's a game that is Tetris. Like, I mean, at this point, that's all you got to say. But at the time, it's like, okay, here's a puzzle game. Anyone can play this, and it's really friendly. Don't have to have super sharp reflexes to enjoy it. just have fun. And yeah, I have cousins. I had older family members, younger family members. I seem to remember that even like Hillary Clinton was a big Tetris fan.
I was just scrolling past down through Reddit and saw a photo of her playing Tetris just earlier this morning.
I think it was printed in Nintendo Power, which is where I heard of it. But yeah, it was literally everywhere. You still can't find anyone really who's like, oh yeah, I've never touched Tetris.
Yeah, I mean, we're recording this in the year 2023, and earlier this year, McDonald's in China introduced a chicken nugget shaped Tetris like handheld, and that became such a phenomenon because people around the world wanted a version of it. So it started getting bought up and exported all over the place. So it was at Long Island this summer. I was playing Chicken Nugget Tetris at the Long Island Expo.
Yeah, they had the whole history of Tetris exhibit on that third floor.
Right. It was like a whole floor of Tetris like variants and ports, and they had the chicken nuggets up there.
Does the chicken nugget aspect bring anything to the table, like game-wise? Or is it just simply shaped like a chicken nugget?
It's just the fact that the handheld itself is shaped like a plastic chicken nugget, yeah.
I see. It doesn't taste like a chicken nugget, smell like a chicken nugget. There's no special chicken nugget piece in the game that changes
Stuart, it. Stuart, I must admit, I failed as a journalist. I did not put the chicken nugget in my mouth.
I see. Okay. So that's the first thing I do when anyone ever hands me anything to review. Straight in the mouth.
Are the pieces at least shaped like chicken McNuggets? Do you have the ball, the boot, etc.?
It's classic Tetris that did not do weird, that did not make weird shapes. They're the Tetris shapes, regular shapes.
So it's good as opposed to gimmicky. That's disappointing.
That is quite disappointing, yeah.
But I couldn't stop playing it.
Tetris for me, and Parrish mentioned it earlier, actually. I never had a Game Boy, but I did have one of those crappy keychains with Tetris on it. And that was Tetris for me. Like I put a lot of time into playing that thing. And it hasn't translated into any kind of contemporary Tetris skill, because when I try and play Tetris now, I suck. I have Tetris Effect, you know, the quite popular VR-y kind of one. And I try to play that, and I can't get past, like, 40 lines. I'm just garbage at Tetris, and I'll never be good at Tetris. I think you have to have a certain type of brain, like maybe a functional one. In order to be good at Tetris, and I just can't do it. You would cringe to watch me play Tetris. I would be sitting there, like, the piece would be coming down, and I would just kind of be going, like, duh. Like, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to play that game. But I like Tetris Attack. I don't know why it's called Tetris Attack. There's nothing like Tetris. But, hey, it's a good game.
Because they still have the license to the name.
So I think that's going to wrap it up for this episode. We've really kind of hit the landmarks of video game history, plus some unexpected little inclusions as well. So that's good. This is what I dreamed of when I threw together this concept for an episode on the spur of a moment. I'm sorry we did not discuss Super Mario Wonder because it's not out yet at the time of this recording. So I guess you Super Mario Wonder fans and enthusiasts who want to know our takes, we'll just have to wait for another episode, but I don't doubt that we will discuss it sometime soonish. So please look forward to the Super Mario Wonder episode as opposed to the Wonder of Super Mario episode. I know it's confusing, but that's just the Retronauts difference. It's all about semantics.
May I jump in here with one last point? I just want to share this.
Please.
Because Stuart mentioned this, and I have to bring it up. So Super Meat Boy was part of a Game Feast promotion, not a summer promotion.
Right,
found the four other games. The four games were Hydrophobia, Comic Jumper.
Oh, dear. Yep.
Pinball FX2. And Super Meat Boy. That was the last. That was the fourth and final one.
Mm-hmm. They saved the best for last there, I would say.
Yeah. I mean, Pinball FX2 had a legacy, I guess.
I do not remember what a Hydrophobia or Comic Jumper even were, to be honest. And I played a lot of Xbox.
Comic Jumper was the game that the people who made Explosion Man and Twisted Pixel, I want to say Twisted Pixel. They made Explosion Man, Ms. Explosion Man, and then they went, where do we go from here? And they made Comic Jumper, and it was very, very unpopular.
All right. So with that being said, thanks, everyone, for taking the time to be part of this episode. I hope those of you listening at home have enjoyed it, despite it not being about Super Mario Wonder, which actually I'm looking at the schedule now, and that game has, as of the time of this release, just come out. So there's that. I'm sure you all have opinions about Super Mario Wonder now, but we do not yet. But don't worry, we will. Look forward to it. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's quite possible that in the whichever is the contemporary episode of this month in Retronauts, there will probably be some talk about Mario Wonder. So, you know, a good reason to sub up.
That's entirely possible. Actually, I might do some rearrangement of the schedule here to get this out just a little bit ahead of the podcast or the game release. I don't know. It'll be a big surprise. Even I don't know what's going to happen yet. But thanks, everyone, for joining us. Now, if everyone wouldn't mind giving their online credentials, where can we find you on the internet? Stuart!
Oh, hello. You can find me on Twitter at Stubacabra, or X as it's now called. I'm also on Blue Sky, but I don't remember what I'm called, so just search for my name on there, I guess. And I don't post on there either, so don't expect exciting posts. Can I plug my book, please? Yeah, I wrote a book. It's called All Games Are Good, and it's about how all games are good. What it's actually about, really, is it's about how your tastes change, so to speak, when you have the incorrect gaming history. Like, your upbringing in gaming is wrong. It's about how you end up that way, but it's also a celebration of lots and lots of little games that I really, really love very, very much, and very, very little in the way of me slagging them off, although there is a bit of that, if that's what you enjoy. And you can get it from Limited Run Games, and a tremendously reasonable $24.99, and it's awesome, and you should definitely buy it.
And it will be on Amazon by the time this episode goes up, so you can buy it there as well.
Yeah, but you should buy it from Limited Run.
You do get more money that way, yes.
Yes, that's exactly
you personally.
Right. Failing that, just find my address, post me vast amounts of money. Like, just get me money however you can. You know, that's what I'm here for.
Diamond, how can we find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me by looking up Fight Club, F E I T. That's my last name. C L U B. That's a English word, and that includes websites like Patreon and Ko-fi and PayPal. Because I'll be frank, I'm in a house with two kids, and they both want the new Super Mario game, and I wonder how I'm going to pay for it. Hey!
All right, and Kevin?
You can find me on social media, on Blue Sky and Twitter under Ubersaurus. I'm on Mastodon occasionally at uberus at mastodon.social. I'm on YouTube under Atari Archive. You can join me on going through some fun bits of game history from the 70s and early 80s through the Atari 2600 library. And as such, I also wrote a book that is available through Limited Run and Amazon by the time this comes out, Atari Archive Volume 1, that covers the first 2 years of the Atari 2600, 1977-78. And delves into a lot of the history around that and its games and the competing platforms of the time.
All right. And finally, you can find me, Jeremy Parrish, on the internet under the name Jeremy Parrish. Unless you're looking at Blue Sky, which is where I mostly post these days, jparrish.bsky.social. Really just rolls off the tongue. Love those URLs. if you happen to be on Blue Sky, that's where you can find me. Otherwise, you can find me on YouTube as Jeremy Parrish, at Limited Run Games as Jeremy Parrish, here on Retronauts as Jeremy Parrish. And I do post occasionally mostly self-promotion stuff on Twitter as GameSpite. Oh, the one weird alias. Okay, anyway, yeah, that's it. So thanks one last time for this discussion. Let us know in the comments or on Discord or whatever if you thought this was an interesting discussion or if we should never come back to this well again. And we will probably do what we decide to do arbitrarily anyway. But you will still be heard, if not obeyed. Anyway, that's it. Good night. I guess I'll never